Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding, and I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have an interview with a 1970s bodybuilder you may not have heard of. His name is Joe Means. Joe is a fixture in a lot of the AAU national level contests in the mid-1970s, and I think his best condition was at the 1976 AAU Mr. America, which was held in, I believe, Philadelphia. And Kalman Skalek, one of my favorite bodybuilders, he won the overall in that. But Joe made a big impression because Joe won the most muscular trophy that night, beating out Cal and Dave Johns and Clint Barile and all the other top guys at the Mr. America that year. And he also notably beat out Tom Platz for best legs. So in that contest, Joe was extremely ripped. So it was interesting to talk to Joe about how his training and diet was back then in the 1970s and how he was able to achieve such incredible rip condition in an era when it was very hard to get that ripped. So we are going to be talking to Joe in a minute. I know you guys are going to love this interview to learn about some old school bodybuilding from the 1970s. And I do want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I have been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner called Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion, as well as 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banute, bodybuilding legend Tom Platz, and Chris Cormier, the real deal. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs supplements that make sense. All right. I hope everybody had a good Easter holiday last weekend. I am still, as you can probably hear, getting over this cold. Took a full week to get over it. I haven't worked out since like last Thursday, so it's been like over 10 days. So I'm anxious to get back to the gym on Monday. I'm going to take a couple more days off. I'm going to go check out the new Avengers Endgame movie tomorrow, which is making unbelievable money. It just came out yesterday. All the theaters around here are sold out. So I'm really looking forward to it. I got some really good reviews, so I'm excited to see it. And then if you're a Game of Thrones fan, there's a big episode coming up this Sunday also. It'll probably be over by the time you guys hear this. But it's supposed to have some huge battle scenes, so I'm looking forward to that as well. Last week, we had the Jerry Scalise interview, and it got some really good comments on Facebook. Mark Anthony Finuccio said it was tremendous. Joe Critelli said Jerry is a great bodybuilder and friend. Sergio Moschia said, I never seen this man before. He has a tremendous physique. Peter McGuff, the great Peter McGuff, said, Jerry is a great guy, great blue-collar bodybuilder. Mick Souza said, one of the best ever. John McIrney said, Jerry had a great physique. Sean Bellon said, good night, phenomenal build. Eric Burke said, he just finished listening, another great podcast. Tom Terwilliger, another great champion, said, great guy, great champion. Dan Dillon, the mayor of bodybuilding, said Jerry Scalise is a Long Island bodybuilding legend, a great guy to talk bodybuilding with. My good friend Dennis Durkin from Chicago, one of my best friends, said another great one, John. I always liked this guy. He had that huge, thick, massive physique. Cool dude. Larry Bernstein, another great bodybuilder from Chicago, who was a short class winner at the Mr. America many times. Larry said, I remember competing against Jerry and thinking, I hope he's not in the short class. So grateful I got to meet and compete with you. Great interview. Samir Banute, 1983 Mr. Olympia, said, fantastic, big Jerry Scalise. Jose Raymond said, another one who definitely would have been a pro today. And Mike Quinn said, one of the strongest and hardest training bodybuilders I've ever trained with. when I did legs with Jerry, I could not get off the floor for about 45 minutes, and I just lied there trying not to vomit. World-class bodybuilder. All right, thanks for all those great comments, guys. That was awesome, and I'm glad you guys loved the interview. I really liked talking to Jerry. He was a real down-to-earth kind of guy. Reminded me of Glenn Kinnear when I did the interview with Glenn Kinnear a couple weeks ago, another old-school Chicago guy. Pat Comer also sent me an email. He said, "Hey, John, I just listened to the Jerry Scalise interview while I trained delts. You mentioned John Fair's Mr. America book, and his other book called Muscletown USA is also a great read. I found a great article on Sergio in the November 1975 issue of Iron Man. It spread over 8 pages, so it would be better if I mailed you a paper copy." And I am going to read that interview for you guys right after we get done with our interview with Joe Means. So stay tuned to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast after the interview. Don't turn it off. Sort of like the credits with the Avengers. You got to stay after the credits. So stay after the interview, and I'm going to read this interview. It was written by Norman Zale, who was a contributor to Iron Man magazine. Norman Zale was a big nutrition guy, like a nutrition expert, and he lived in Chicago, and he promoted a lot of contests at the Leaning Tower YMCA, which was in Skokie, Illinois. And Norman Zale actually judged my very first contest that I was in when I was 16 years old. So he was a real mainstay in the Chicago area, and he had a lot of greats come out to his contest to guest pose, including Arnold, Sergio, and Frank Zane, all the top guys at that time. So we are going to read this article about Sergio that appeared in the 1975 issue of Iron Man magazine. And thank you to Pat Comer again for being a great supporter of the show and sending me that article. All right. In other news, I do have to mention something sad. Mike Katz's wife passed away this week. And Mike Katz, of course, 1970 Mr. America winner and one of the stars of the movie Pumping Iron and the book Pumping Iron. We've had him on the podcast several times. And I think the last time we talked to Mike was when Ed Corney passed away. And I believe he mentioned that his wife was in the hospital. I don't know if he mentioned it on the interview or he mentioned it to me. So unfortunately, she did pass away. So our condolences go out to Mike Katz and his family, his son, and also his daughter, and all his relatives and friends of Mike Katz's wife. That was very sad. So I hope they're doing okay. I also want to wish my mom a happy birthday. She's going to have a birthday on the 30th, which is Tuesday. So I'm very blessed to have my mom and dad still in great health. I have great, great parents, if you've ever met them. They're really, really great people, and I'm really, really, really lucky to have them. So wish my mom a happy birthday. All right, before we get to our interview with Joe Means, I also want to mention that we are brought to you by our other sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then you should go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So you can call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida at 813-922-8939, but they will work with anybody in the continental United States. Again, it's 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. And if you mention that you heard the ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will give you 20% off your first order. And I also want to mention that they have a new supplement out called the Magic Pill, and it is developed and backed by science. It's a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. So this is a revolutionary fat-burning product. It's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. And if you want a month's supply of this fat loss pill and a thermogenic, you can just call them at 813-922-8939, and you can order your own supply. And I believe it is $39.99 for a month's supply. But mention that you heard the ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, so that is it for our opening. Here is our interview with Joe Means, one of the top national-level bodybuilders in the AAU in the 1970s. Here we go. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and we have a very special guest on the line. His name is Joe Means, and Joe was one of the top bodybuilders in the 1970s competing in the AAU. Welcome to the show, Joe. Glad to have you on.
Thanks. My pleasure, John.
Well, Joe, I remember you from reading the magazines. You were one of the most ripped guys, especially back in the 1970s before the guys were really getting really shredded back then. So it'd be interesting to find out how you achieved that look. Let's start with the beginning, Joe. How did you get involved in bodybuilding? What got you started?
I really started at an early age. I was about 12 or 13, and I got, I think I was reading, you know, it went to the newsstand and saw some bodybuilding magazines and started reading them and got intrigued by it. And I had a fairly good natural physique, and I guess you sort of want to work on that. And I was playing other sports like football, and so I just wanted to, you know, get in better shape and better built.
Yeah.
And I had like an older neighbor down the street that he bought a York set, and he put it in his garage, and I'd go over there and work out a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I just sort of got bit by the bug early, and I continued, you know, working out through high school. I continued working out. And fortunately, I think my junior year of high school, there were some local guys that had a backyard gym, mm-hmm. and they had a lot of iron Olympic sets and no machines, of course. It was a very hardcore type gym. And they were like into powerlifting and some bodybuilding and even arm wrestling. They were really into it. Mm-hmm. And they were really, a guy that owned it was named Buck Baxley. And he really, he had an older guy he looked up to that I think won Mr. South Carolina, one of the top bodybuilders in Rock Hill. And he moved away, and then Bucky sort of followed his steps. And there was another policeman there in town named Snow Roseborough, and he was well known for his physique, and he was also a wrestler. He had also, you know, wrestled throughout the Southeast, and he was really well developed. Mm-hmm. And so they sort of took me under their wing and let me work out there, and I really got my real start in bodybuilding then. And I think it was the first time I saw the Iron Man magazine. I'd see muscular development in some of the Weider magazines, but never Iron Man, and I got to see that. And I think Bucky, he carried me to my first contest, which I entered in 1969 in Durham North, and I got 10th place as an 18-year-old teenager.
Oh, wow. And,
yeah.
Where did you grow up? I didn't ask you that.
Oh, Rock Hill, South Carolina.
Okay.
I'm about 70 miles north, south of that now, in Columbia, which is the capital of South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And Rock Hill is about 20 miles south of Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay. So what was it like doing that first contest? You said you got 10th place as an 18-year-old. That had to be quite an experience, huh?
Yeah, I was sort of overwhelmed, you know, but I think it was about 15 in it, so I did get last place. But I learned a lot, and, you know, I really didn't know how to pose and, you know, very elementary posing. And I got to see, you know, the guy that won was Terry Moore. He looked great, but he was short-lived. I think he ended up getting third with Chris Dickerson and Boyer Coe in the junior USA, a junior Mr. America a few months after that. So he was top national caliber. The second place was L. Darden, and I think third place was a guy named Ed Thompson out of Texas, too.
Oh, okay. Talk a little bit about that gym you went to. That sounds like, I remember back in the old days, there weren't a lot of gyms around. People may have a hard time believing that now, but it wasn't in vogue to work out. So like you said, you were going to that one gym where it was just all heavy equipment, and it was just power lifters and bodybuilders and arm wrestlers, right?
You're right. And it was like a garage built in the backyard and a workshop, and it was converted to a nice gym. He had, I think, a heater, a little gas heater put in it for the wintertime, and he had I don't think he had air in it, just had a fan that he had put in it, so that was kind of rough.
Right.
But it was really good, and there was a real good strong men in Rock Hill. It's sort of entertaining, you know. They wasn't real regular. I think I was one of the one that frequented there all the time. Of course, Bucky did too. The owner, Snow, was occasional. He'd go in and he'd work out at home more than he did there. But some of the guys would frequent in and out, and a lot of those guys went to Olympic lifting was big at that time, and some of them were Olympic lifters and some powerlifting as well.
Yeah. Well, you don't see that much at all anymore, you know, the Olympic lifting.
But it was a lot of homemade equipment. I think one of the guys was a welder and welded and some of the equipment in there. But it didn't have any machines at all, just mainly benches and hard iron.
Yeah. Did you gravitate toward the bodybuilding, Joe, or did you try a little powerlifting and Olympic lifting too?
I was always a bodybuilder. They had a chalkboard put up of everybody's poundages.
Uh-huh.
And they finally put me on there. I remember I had, I think, 180-pound bench press, I think, as a junior in high school, which I thought was great. But my squat was pretty good. It was coming along. I think it was over 300 pounds at that time. Deadlift was about the same, you know. But I really didn't focus on that. I was more into, just working out.
Mm-hmm.
He had an array of magazines in there. He had his collection in there. So I'd finish working out and flip through those.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great place to start. I think there was the only gym in town at that time. But Charlotte had the YMCA, mm-hmm. which we'd go there occasionally on a Saturday and work out. And a lot of the wrestlers like Ric Flair and Steamboat and some of them were there around that time. Ole Anderson, so that was sort of cool.
But yeah,
we just occasionally, and they did finally a little later. They ended up having a real chrome type gym built, but it was too expensive for me, you know, to join.
Right,
it looked nice, but I didn't want to travel that far and pay that kind of money.
Right. Who were the bodybuilders you looked up to when you were first starting, Joe?
Who was big then? Of course, Steve Reeves was huge. Larry Scott, mm-hmm. Grimmick, a lot of traditional. Dave Draper.
Yeah.
I liked and some of the others. Randy Watson. You know, he was a good national caliber bodybuilder. Ended up meeting him later on. He was a manager of district manager of European health spas, and ended up becoming a national health spa later on.
Okay. So after you did that first show when you were 18, what was your competitive career like after that?
I left Rock Hill shortly thereafter. I got a job at the FBI. They were hiring high school graduates and right after high school and to work in the identification division. So I moved up there, and there was a nice gym up there that in Alexandria, Virginia, that I joined, and I met a few of the local bodybuilders, one of them being Jan Novak, which was a top bodybuilder in that area at that time. He had already won, I think, he was soon to win Mr. DC and some of the Del Marva and some of those in Maryland. But mm-hmm. He was an accomplished bodybuilder there, and he was sort of an inspiration to me then. And we become pretty good friends, and we worked out some. Our schedules were different, but we worked out some together.
Mm-hmm.
And so then... I think I entered Mr. DC around 1970 when I was living up there, and I got fifth.
Okay.
And I think Jan won, but I got fifth. And let's see. And I didn't enter anything else until I moved back here, and I got sort of went back to work, went to work here, left the FBI, and went to work here at the State Law Enforcement Division, or what we call acronym of SLED, S-L-E-D.
Okay.
And here, and they had a nice, it was a European health spa, and it was a real pretty good place to work. It was more of a chrome type gym with, you know, real thick rugs and everything. And it was Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the men would work out, and Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, the female day. So it's sort of a routine.
Okay. Wow, they had different days for the women, huh? That's funny.
Yeah, it wasn't co-ed like it is now.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
But in 73, I decided to try another contest.
Uh-huh.
And it was Birmingham, Alabama. And I went down there and I placed fourth. And I got real excited because that's the first time I really, really, you know, placed sort of high in it. And it was pretty good competition. And I was starting to make headway. So then about 6 months or so later, I continued working out hard. Mm-hmm. And there was a contest in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I think it was called Mr. Tri-State.
Okay.
And there, and it was about 30 people in that contest, because it was people from North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia, and mm-hmm. another place. So, and I ended up winning it. So I was really elated then. And,
yeah.
So that really got me hooked, you know, when I got, you know, some accomplishment winning a contest. So I got excited about that. And then the next year, I think I won, entered in 74, I won Mr. South Carolina and entered the comeback. And my goal when I got washed out of that Mr. South as a teenager, I said, I want to come back here one day and win this thing. So I came back in 74 and entered Mr. South. And the guy that placed second to me, he switched and beat me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was very, very close. And So I came back in 75, and of course I won it. And I won every subdivision, you know, back then, you know, they had
the body parts.
So I won all subdivisions.
Yeah.
And everything sort of dominated. And then I entered a few more local contests, and I was winning them, so I felt like I was dominating. So I said, I'm going to go on, and some people encouraged me to go on the national level, so I started competing at the national level then.
Okay. What was your physique looking like at this point, Joe? Were you just bigger, or were you getting more ripped, or what was the key to your success?
I was a little bigger. I was still, I've never been a huge person, but I was symmetrical, and I guess because I entered the Mr. America in 75, went out to California.
Uh-huh.
And the year Dale Adrian won.
Yeah.
And of course, Navy, you know, he looked very good. He almost won it. Robbie Robinson, Clint Bowerly. It was very well stacked. And I think I got 10th that year, if I remember.
Uh-huh.
And, but, you know, I really wasn't called back for anything. I made a good appearance. A lot of people told me I looked good and everything. So I went up, and I think it was Ralph Countryman. I went up to one of the judges. I said, what do I need to do to place in a contest? He said, Joe, he said, when you get up there and pose, you look great, but I just don't see any magic. I said, you need definition. You need cuts.
Hmm.
And so those words, you know, hit me hard. It hurt. But, you know, I went back to work. I said, well, I'm going to come in and cut next year.
Yeah.
And that's why I made the big transition in 76 is when I came in and, you know, it made the huge impression with my definition.
Yeah, because I'm looking at your contest history here. You got, like, I think you said, like, 10th in America in 75. And then 76, you go to the Junior USA. You win the whole thing. Then you go to the USA, and you got second in your class, and you won most muscular. And then, as you said, you went to the Mr. America, which was very competitive, and you took second in your class. And then you beat Kalman Skalak, who won the overall. You beat him for the most muscular, which was pretty wild.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was real real excited. I think that year, I think I entered what they call a Coastal USA, and I let's see, what did I get? I got third place.
Yeah, third. That's what it sounds here. Yeah.
April. Yeah. And I won a lot of the subdivisions, including muscular.
Uh-huh.
And then I entered the next one was Junior Mr. America, and I got second. And I started really getting some headway. And I think some of the people that placed in or even won the Coastal, you know, didn't hardly place in that contest.
Mm-hmm.
So I must have made a tremendous transformation during that time to get more definition. And so I made a huge impression then. So then I said, well, I'm going to go back to America. And I kept dieting and getting ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way up there, I think, you know, I had friends, you know, living in D.C. I stayed with my old roommate for a couple of days. And I went to Spartan Gym, and that's where Mensa worked out at.
Oh, okay.
So I got to work out and see him for a day or two there. He was very friendly and enjoyed, you know, talking to him and listening to his philosophy on dieting and training, which was unusual. And but he was very smart. I you know, learned a lot from him. But then I went on. But he was about 6 weeks away from, I believe, the Mr. America, the Weider, which he ended up winning.
Right, the ITV. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he wasn't even close at that time. And, of course, I was ready for the contest.
It
was
before
the contest. So I was ripped. So I went on to the, Mr. America, and I noticed, and they kept calling me out for every subdivision, you know, every comparison. So I knew I was in the money. And then after it was over with, you know, right after prejudging, I think it was John Bailey come up to me. He said, Joe, he said, you made a tremendous impression out there. He said, I wouldn't be surprised if you win this thing. I think it's going to be between you and Kalman Skalak. He has an all-American look and everything, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a good impression out there. He said, just what they want.
Yeah.
And so I knew I was in the money. But Dave Johns ended up winning the he was a huge guy, and he ended up winning by 1 point the medium height class.
Mm-hmm.
It was high classes back then. So he ended up by 1 point, he won the medium. but I didn't win best legs, and Tom Platz was in that contest, so I beat him with best legs.
Wow, that's a feather in your cap, huh? You beat Tom Platz for best legs.
Yeah, I'm sure I wouldn't have done it later on when he peeked his legs out.
Yeah.
But I was so ripped, you know, that nobody could handle the definition. I caught everybody by surprise.
Well, like I said, when I saw those pictures, and I remember seeing them when I was a youngster, when I was reading the magazines, I remember how shocking you looked, you know, because you were so shredded. What kind of diet were you following then, Joe? Because, you know, bodybuilders didn't know a lot about nutrition back then, right? I mean, it was a lot of guesswork.
Yeah, you know, and I was sort of different than most people because I was from South Carolina. I was probably the only bodybuilder around, in a competitive bodybuilder at that time, and around that time it was. So I sort of, you know, had to what I'd read in the magazines or what I go to contests and try to, you know, get information from other bodybuilders, and so I really didn't have any coach or anything like they have now. And,
right.
So it's sort of winging it. So when the judge told me, I said, you need to cut up. And so, and what I was doing wrong. And I know I talked to L. Darden at the Coastal USA, and he always talked a little bit about diet. And he's a little, it's different than what most bodybuilders, they're always talking about high protein, low or no carbs. He said, you need carbs. Protein is good, but you need a balanced type diet. Mm-hmm. And it's probably somewhere in between. But when I found out what I was doing wrong, and I was eating a lot of steaks, you know, before, mm-hmm. trying to eat a lot of food, and I was eating a lot of protein and low carbs, but that was still smoothing me out.
The steaks. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So I cut back and I was eating more chicken and fish.
Yeah.
And some beef, you know, lean cuts of beef. And I was eating a lot of salads and some green vegetables like green beans. And I think I would have something like cantaloupe and cottage cheese, you know, every few days.
Okay.
When energy was lacking somewhat. But I was pretty much, you know, and I'd always have eggs in the morning for breakfast, several eggs, and usually a couple pieces of bacon, too. But I never really filled up. My quantity was probably real, about a third of what I was eating before, and staying a little hungry all the time.
Yeah.
And I was having to drink a lot of coffee because I felt like that was cutting my appetite.
Oh, okay.
Drink some coffee between meals. Uh-huh. I get hungry to have a cup of coffee. And I don't know if that helps or not, but I was doing it. But that seemed to be, you know, just keeping the high protein, low carbohydrate diet, very low, and keeping my calorie intake probably around 1,500 to 1,800 calories a day.
Okay.
Seemed to work. You're just peeling fat off of me.
So you still kept the carbs low, but you seem like you lowered the fats even more because you stopped eating more of the steak and started eating more white meat and stuff.
I was just eating, and what I assume is what I do, I was eating so much protein and probably fat, it may be converting some of that protein to carbohydrate and just keeping me. I was still fairly, but it wasn't super. It wasn't cut enough to be in a contest. It was,
yeah, gotcha.
And it wasn't like the judge said, you didn't get the magic when you went under the lights.
Right.
You had to have some definition, and I just didn't have it.
So Ellington Darden, he was kind of a disciple of Arthur Jones, right? And he believed in eating a little bit more carbohydrates. I think Mensur had the same philosophy too, right? Mensur was always eating a little carbohydrates too.
Yeah. I didn't really go when I was competing. I did keep my carbohydrates pretty low, but I didn't even it out like he did, like he mentioned.
Yeah.
And I did preach that, but he said it always goes back to total calories during the day. And it's true to a point, but I think it is something to do with the choice, the type of food it is as well, like with carbohydrates or protein. All that matters.
Right. What was your training like back then, Joe? I mean, I know you started with the basics and stuff with the free weights. So when you were entering these national level shows like the America and the Junior USA, how many days a week were you training? What was that like?
I was pretty much on the 6-day split routine.
Okay.
And I think I do pushing muscles one day, pulling, and then the legs the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And did that pretty much, you know, right before a contest. I was training pretty much like that, split routine. But I was fortunate, as I said, when I moved back to Columbia, they did have a nice gym, but it was like the only bench press they had was in a Smith machine.
Yeah.
From Smith machines. And there was nowhere to do squats except in that Smith machine. So it was very limited, no really bodybuilding equipment there, but I was able to manage and still working out pretty good. If you got genetics and you're training correctly and doing, you know, resistance is resistance. And if you got the will and the will and the way to do it,
yeah,
it still work. But it'd make it so much better if you had quality equipment for body. So when I won the Mr. South contest up in Durham, North Carolina, a guy named Maitland Nance, he said he was one of the judges. He come back after the contest. He said, "Joe, where you training?" I told him. I said, "It's really a very limited gym where I work it out." He said, "Well, I got a friend that he went. He's a doctor there in Columbia, and said he's got the whole setup right at his house. He's got he bought every Nautilus machine that Arthur Jones ever produced right in his home gym."
Wow.
He just works out there by himself. And he said he would love to have you if just give him a call. He's a nice guy, and I felt a little funny about that, but I was really needing a place to work out at, and so I looked him up in the phone book and gave Dr. John Morgan, he's a local dermatologist, and I called him and he was, you know, bluff, gruff, and to the point. He said, "Yeah, if you want to work out, come at 5:30 tomorrow and we'll work out." There, and I worked out a few days and it didn't have a key, you know, and I think he was late, so I had to miss a day. So I went back to the other gym, worked out, and I missed the gym. And he called me up and said, "Joe, you hadn't been to the gym late." And I said, "Well, I couldn't get in." He said, "Well, let me give you a key." So I figured, I think I sort of had the wrong impression. You know, I said, "Well, I don't think he really wants to work it out here."
Yeah,
yeah. Skipped off. You know, you read people wrong. He's quiet.
Right.
And, So I was still working out, and I worked out there ever since, all during my he had free weights, too. He had pulleys. He sort of tailor-made it to the best equipment he ever had. And he was a disciple when he was, I think, when he was going through his medical training down in Tampa, Florida. And that's where Jim Hazelip and Frank Zane and a lot of those guys were working out at the time. It was like the Muscle Beach of the East Coast.
Right, right.
So he was working out there, and I think that's where he really got his interest. It was called Harry's Gym, I think.
Harry Smith. Yeah, I know him. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was some good Doug Betts. You see those guys, a lot of those guys, Craig Whitehead, the doctor there,
and
a lot of those guys he would work out with, you know, and see him in the gym every day. And of course, the best one was Zane, of course.
Yeah.
And he would work out with him, and so he had that background, and he enjoyed working out, and he saw the science behind the Nautilus machines, and he went down there and visited the Nautilus plant and was very impressed with them. So he decided to go ahead and there was no really great machines at that time that were scientific that fit the body weld, you know, to as well as Nautilus did. So of course he went all out. And I bought every one of them.
Hmm.
And so I loved it. You know, I started working out at Nautilus machines.
Yeah, okay.
And I met L. Darden, you know, at the Coastal USA, and he became very impressed with me. So he stayed in touch with me, and then he invited me a couple years later to come back and do the book.
Yeah.
The Nautilus. So I stayed about 6 weeks down there posing and working on all the machines. I just took time off from work. From a job, it made sort of like a semi-vacation, working vacation doing that.
Okay.
And so that was fun. I got to meet Arthur Jones and all the staff down there.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, so I saw you were on the cover of that book. Are you inside the book too, Joe?
Yeah. I demonstrated all the exercises and all the machines and everything too.
Okay. What year did that book come out?
I think it was 1980 or 81.
All right. What did you think of Arthur Jones?
Yeah, of course, you know, he was quite a character. Everybody knows. He was very friendly. He would come over. He was very busy. But he would come over and usually sit around, and in between some of the shots, he'd come over and speak to me. So Arthur came out, and he said, "Joe," he said, "I want you to go in and see my crocodiles. I got some of the largest in the world." So I didn't know he was actually wanting me to go inside the fenced in area where they were. So we're draining it at the time, and they had to clean it out every day because they get a stench. And so they were draining it out, and so it was all the water was out of it. So we ended up walking in, and they were all sort of, you know, along the side, and we had a walkway where we were walking around, and he was going through. He was kicking at them, and as he's walking around and talking to them, the second largest in the world. And so he said, this one here is the alpha of the group. He don't, but this one over here realizes, I think he could be, but he just don't know it yet. But he's really the best one in here. And like every male has two or three females in their harem. And you don't mess, you know, in their territory, or, you know, they'll take your head off.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So how big were they? Were they huge?
Oh, they were tremendous. You know, he would get the biggest he could. I think he said he had the second largest in the world in there. Mm-hmm. And I believed him. So they started filling it back up with water about that time. And he said, Joe, if we're about two-thirds of the way out. And they started growling.
Wow.
He said, you better move. He said, it's time to go. And so we started running out, and they were getting aggressive. And he said, what it is that when there's no water in there, they're not aggressive. They're not territorial.
Uh-huh.
He said, but a little, 1 inch of water in there, he said, they change and they become aggressive and territorial, and they rip us to pieces.
Damn, so that's unbelievable.
Secret, you know, why we were able to walk in there during that time.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Did he have snakes there too on this farm?
I think he had a huge python there, if I can remember, but I'm mm-hmm. not sure.
Yeah.
But I just remember mainly the crocodiles is where he had at the land. He had another, I think at his house, he had a farmhouse somewhere, and he had like a zoo there. And I think that's where he had the snakes and things.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But I never went there.
How did the book do as far as selling and stuff?
The book I was in?
Yeah, the one you were on the cover.
I think the time when you know, health and fitness books were selling, but mm-hmm. it was a top seller, and I had friends. That one friend of mine went to Italy, you know, training for the National Guard. He said, Joe, they had the books all over the newsstands there.
Hmm.
And another friend was in Spain, and he saw it in Spain. But El said it was a bestseller. And it really took off.
Yeah. Wow. And, that's great. Yeah, you're right. The bodybuilding books were pretty big back then because obviously that was before the internet. So everybody got the books to get information, right?
Yeah. But, you know, usually a lot of the guys on Facebook that are friends of the bodybuilders, they say, yeah, I got your Nautilus bodybuilding book. I've always followed it. So I've always, mm-hmm. A lot of friends, you know, a lot of people that train the Nautilus methods have made a huge influence, I think, on a lot of the young bodybuilders at that time.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Joe, I wanted to ask you about some of the shows you went in, because in some of those contests in the 1970s, you competed against some real famous guys.
Yeah.
That 1976 USA, where you got second to Dave Johns, that was won by Manuel Perry. What did you think of him? Because he was kind of a new up-and-coming guy, right?
Yeah, that's the first time I'd seen him, and he was very impressive. He had huge arms, shoulders, and he looked very impressive.
He was a California guy.
Yeah, yeah. First time I'd seen him, and I think, you know, I always heard a lot of times when it makes a huge impression when you got a new face and you come out with a real, like Colman Skulik did, nobody really mm-hmm. seen him before. He came out with a new face and a great build, and it's a shock.
Yeah.
Daniel Perry was able to do the same thing, came out with a great look and a great physique and a new look, and it's a huge impression.
Yeah.
Really hoping that I would go down and win the USA that year. But, you know, you just don't know. You know, of course, I won, made another good impression, and I, you know, won most muscular. And I think Dave Johns, he won the height class, if I remember, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just hard, you know, beating the guys that were weighing 30 or 40 pounds more than I was. It's hard competing, especially with the height classes at that time, with a more defined physique. But I felt like being a smaller type bodybuilder, that I found my niche in being highly defined, you know, really helped me place much higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that why you think you were able to win the most muscular? Because you won the most muscular at the USA and the America that year, and you beat out a lot of these big guys for that title. So the most muscular was it wasn't just size, obviously. It was the guy who was the most ripped, right?
Yeah, yeah. The most definition, everything. Yeah, so I was very pleased with that. And I sort of get, in my mind anyway, but I feel like I'd won a contest there, you know, just winning the most muscular.
Yeah.
For the overall winner, yeah, I still take pride in that.
Yeah, I think Robbie won the most muscular, didn't he, in 75, when a lot of people thought he should have placed higher?
Yeah, and I think that's what they did, especially in previous years. If they found out another guy had maybe a superior muscular development, or you know, they would win the most muscular other than the title.
Yeah.
Might have been as well balanced. There's other reasons why they did it.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about Dave Johns, because a lot of our younger listeners may not remember Dave Johns, but I do. I remember he won the American 77. He was a very thick, massive guy, especially for back then.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was huge, and I remember I competed with him a lot. And, of course, he got to be my main nemesis, you know, because he was always in, you know, that year in 76, he was always – I got second to him at the Junior Mr. America, second to him in my height class at the Mr. America, and then second to him at the USA.
Yeah.
It got to be, that's who I was really after that year.
Yeah.
And just couldn't quite pull it off. But, of course, it was left to the judges' hands. And it was one where you got a huge, monstrous guy with a good, well-balanced physique against a smaller, more defined guy with a very proportionate physique. So it's getting really what you want. But Dave was very personable. He was very impressive, you know, had huge arms. I know, but he wore a shirt, you know. I think he had to split them because his arms were so big.
Like Sergio. Yeah.
Yeah. Davis. And he was very impressive, and he was like a Sergio with his size and everything. And I think he trained at Bill Pearl's gym.
Yeah, he did. And
probably traveled some together. I'd see him there together. They had a room at some of the contests and see them, and they were – it was some of Pearl's disciples.
Okay. And what did you think about Cal Kelman, the guy who won the America in 76?
The only time I saw him was at the 76 Mr. America, and he looked very good. He was polished, had a great physique, great arms, great chest. His legs were a little lacking, and probably he could use a little more definition, but I think he was able to carry it, you know, by the judges' standards, you know, by his complete physique overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people were saying he was the next Arnold because he had that chest and back.
He was, you know, with his size and everything, he could have been like an Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
He was very impressive.
Was he shocked when you beat him for the most muscular?
I think he probably, I bet he said, oh, no, what's going to happen now?
Yeah, right. And how was Tom Platz back then? Because you were in the contest against a very young Tom Platz. He had to be in his early 20s back then, right?
Yeah, yeah. He was young, and he was a little thick. And I think he was just getting on the scene like a year or two before. And he didn't have a really – you could see the potential there, but he just didn't have the complete – and his legs were already there as prototype. But he didn't have it as what he would need at the national level.
Okay. So it was you and him for best legs then, and you won.
If I can remember, I think he was in best legs too. And somebody else was in there. If I remember, they were posing legs with me. But I always like to tease and say that I beat Tom Platz for best legs.
Right. But what about Ron Tufo? Because he was another guy that was very impressive back then. Very young guy. I think he was only probably 19 at that time, right?
He was a funny type guy. You know, I always enjoyed competing with him. And he was thickly developed, and he got best abs. He won abs, which is, you know, I thought it was controversial again. He had thick, very thick abs, but mine were more defined, and I had more serratus. And I've heard it argued both ways, you know, but, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
But I thought I would won best abs, but, you know, he ended up, you know, taking it. But I think he'd never lost. And the magazine said he'd never lost best abs, so he had a reputation.
I remember reading that too, yeah, because he had those super thick abs.
Yeah, he was thick. And he did improve, you know, somewhat overall, you know, even got better, I think, as years went on.
And then you went in the America again in 79, and that was a very tough, I think there was 19 guys in your class, and you took third behind Ray Mensah and Greg DeFerro, so that was a really good showing again, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, and I came back and said, man, I said, well, you know, in order to win, I've got to carry a little more size. So I did, you know, go in about 5 or 10 pounds heavier.
Okay.
And try not to sacrifice. I probably wasn't extremely defined as I was before, but I was close.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it gave me a better overall look, but it was just, there again, you had Mentor was weighing probably 220, 230 and DeFerro about the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just humongous size. And I remember, Mentor, we were backstage and, Mentor was, I think they originally had him in the tall class. And then, and he was sort of, and he made some of the guys mad in the tall class because he got in there. And so then he ducked down, and I think he ended up getting in. He was right on the borderline of it, so he ended up getting in the middle class. And I didn't care because I said, well, you know, I'd always read about Ray Mentor. He always comes in smooth, and he's not. And I didn't look at him as a real competition, but he came in at his best ever.
Right.
He came in and fit the kill. Then he was cut. He had fully. He had a great physique that year.
Yeah, he did.
First, he went on. He had tremendous size and arms and good look. He looked like Rocky.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah. It's sort of a disheartening looking at this list now. I'm looking at a lot of these guys who have passed away, like Greg DeFerro passed away, Ray Mentor passed away, Dave Johns passed away, Ron Tufel. A lot of these guys are no longer with us. I mean, it was a while back, but it's sad that a lot of them are no longer here.
Yeah, it's sad, you know, so many people competed with, they're no longer here, but it's so many of the friends, and you think you'd want to, you know, have good health on in the later years, and you enjoy it, but that's not the case with them.
Yeah, life is funny that way.
Yeah.
Joe, did you ever have any plans to compete in the IFBB as a professional? Because I know that's when the Olympia was getting more popular in the late 70s. And, you know, they had the Mr. International that was held with the Olympia in Columbus, Ohio, you know, in between 76 and 79.
You know, I think I was getting to the turning point in my career where I started having, I was in my career at SLED, which I enjoyed a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was getting a little more demanding. And, you know, all the time I was bodybuilding, you know, bodybuilding was sort of first and the job was second.
Yeah.
It was probably hurting my career some. So, and they did, the agency did pretty much support me and everything. We're proud of me doing so well in bodybuilding. But, you know, I thought that I probably needed to level out some. Plus, I started, you know, I got married and I had a family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was getting pulled different ways. And I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to retire. You know, I'm competitive about it, try to live a more balanced life.
Okay.
You know,
the FBI, the agency you were with, they were supportive of it, though, huh? They thought it was cool that you were a bodybuilder.
Oh yeah, yeah. They really liked it, and they did support me. And as I said, they gave me time off.
Yeah.
I had plenty of leave, you know, to take. But they gave me any contest and everything. They would allow me to take my leave time and go. So they were very supportive of it, and of course, it gave them publicity as well.
Mm-hmm.
You get positive publicity for the agency, that's good for them too.
Yeah. Were you featured in magazines and newspapers and stuff back then, Joe, when you placed high?
Yeah, we had the guy at SLED at that time. He was a public information officer. He was with the state newspaper. And he started getting me some local, and they hadn't never had that before. It sort of caught them off guard.
Mm-hmm.
But they started getting publicity, and I was even put on. They had on Channel 10 News, which is the big news station here, a big television station. They had what they called a Sunday night feature, which showed different features in the community or different stories going on. And they did a story they dedicated to me. It's a 30-minute segment, I believe.
Wow.
Where they followed me to the 79 Mr. America in Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
and filmed the contest when I was there. And they did come to work out and did a, you know, they did an interview with me, and they did a workout, you know, me training.
Yeah.
And did an interview with me and sort of, and it even showed me at work, you know, every day. And so it was a great show, and I don't have a copy of it now. I've tried to find it, but, you know, didn't think to save it at the time, but it was a great 30-minute show, which would show throughout the state.
Yeah.
And, but I thought that was great. And But they did. They followed, had the crew down there because I thought I had a good chance of possibly winning the 79. And, of course, you know, I still made a good placing. Third is great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, yeah, it's interesting when you look back at those days in the 70s and the early 80s, you know, how the mass media thought bodybuilding was so interesting. And newspapers would cover it, magazines, television. They really thought it was fascinating that these guys had these muscles. You know, it was such a new concept back then.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's why it was funny. The first time that they featured me in one of the local newspapers here when I won a contest, they didn't put, I thought it'd have it in the sports section. They put it in the, it was a community section, I think.
And right.
That caught me off guard. They just didn't know how to handle it at first.
Yeah. Do you still stay in touch with bodybuilding, Joe? Do you watch what's going on with the current contest?
I really don't, other than the internet.
Yeah.
I hadn't been to a bodybuilding show in years. After I retired, I still did. I had a lot of connections. They'd have me come back and judge for a while, which I'm glad I did. But I haven't been to a show in years. And other than, you know, just seeing what's on the internet now, you know, I'm not as familiar with a lot of the newer guys there now.
Yeah, it is much different now because they added all those new divisions now where they never had that before. It was just bodybuilding before.
Yeah. But as I was saying before, you know, I just think I came to a decision where I either had to go pro, you know, and go on in the IFBB or, you know, dedicate my career. And I just thought I better go ahead and make my career. Because I felt like I was entering all these contests and I was coming in second or third and I just couldn't win it, you know, due to my natural, you know, limitation with size. And so, you know, and I thought that that may be a, you know, a factor too that, you know, I could always go in and place high in a contest.
Yeah.
Probably not, you know, because there's always going to be a Mensah, a DeFerro, a Manuel Perry, a Dave Johns in there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So how long did you work for the FBI then?
2 years I worked for the FBI.
Okay.
And it's ironic there because I was enjoying my career up there, but they ended up, they implemented a weighing program where they'd weigh you every time you go up for a grade raise. And I was going up for a huge promotion up there, and they'd give you body frames, and you had to weigh a maximum amount that you could weigh for your frame. And they gave me an extra large frame, and I couldn't weigh but 176 five nights, and I was weighing 200 pounds.
Yeah.
And that was getting a little difficult to try to, and I was working out pretty good then, and I was all solid and no fat.
Right.
So I thought it had been unhealthy to try to, you know, get to that body weight. It had been hard to keep that body weight at that size.
Yeah.
And I made an appeal, and it went all the way, and I went to the assistant director, and that was during J. Edgar Hoover was there.
Oh, okay.
And he said, the assistant director said, I see your point, Means. He said, you're right, but Director Hoover don't make no exceptions. He said, it's going to stop here. And I had a job offer already from the state, so it worked out perfectly.
Yeah. You worked at the other job until you retired, then.
Yeah. Yeah, I worked there 37 years until I retired.
Wow, that's
and
great.
I still go, they call me back, retired agents. They still call us back for special occasions and stuff to work.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. All right. Mm-hmm. All right, Joe, thanks for joining us on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. It's a pleasure talking to you. I've been following your careers, like I said, since I was a teenager. So it was great to hear the stories of when you competed in the top shows in the country.
Well, it's my pleasure, John, and I always enjoyed reading your articles and your other podcasts as well.
All right. So thank you.
Honored to be selected for this.
Oh, absolutely. It was an honor having you on here.
Okay.
All right, Joe. Thanks for joining us.
Nice talking to you, John.
All right, nice talking to you. Take care.
Bye.
All right, thank you for listening to this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs, for again sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And without further ado, I am going to now read this article that was written by Norman Zale, and it appeared in the November 1975 issue of Iron Man magazine. And it's called Sergio Oliva, a Legendary Superman. It starts off, Sergio, 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 roared the crowd as Oliva completed his second curtain call. As the big Cuban again mounted the posing dais for the third time that evening, the sweat glistened on his brow and immense shoulders.
The crowd moved forward in their seats to get a closer look at one of the best-built and most highly developed muscular humans the world has ever seen. He checked his position under the posing lights, and all was quiet, almost an eerie quiet, as if the audience had left the darkened auditorium. The big man squatted in a circle of light, extended his left leg out to the side, and slowly raised both arms up into the classic double arms bicep shot. Pandemonium reigned. Shouts, screams, groans, flashbulbs popped, chairs overturned, as every breathing body in the house surged forward. He knew he had them in the palm of his hand, this refugee from communism, and he loved every second of it. Still balancing on his right leg, he turned his back to the throng, and never was such a back scene. Stretching his arms out to the sides, he first wiggled his triceps, and then he flexed his biceps as the audience gasped in awe. He spread those super wide lats, and people tripped over their own feet in an attempt to get closer to the stage to see if they were real. Raising his arms overhead, he slowly lowered them until they were parallel to the floor and alternately isolated his scapula and tensed the smaller muscles of his upper back, the muscles which make a good back great. It looked like he had snakes crawling under his sweat-soaked skin, and the mob loved it. This is what they had paid hard cash to see. Yes, there was a Mr. What-You-May-Call-It contest, but not one soul in the audience could tell you the name of the winner who had just been crowned 15 minutes previous. So mesmerized has the crowd been that they lost all sense of time and reason. In 15 short minutes, 900 seconds, this man, who many believe to be the greatest physique the world has ever seen, took complete control and dominated all within sight without uttering a word. He slowly turned around to face his admirers, and was greeted by clapping hands, stamping feet, and shouts of more, more. He slowly raised that ham-like arm for silence, and all were still. Someone threw him a towel from off stage, and it was a muscle show just to see him wipe the sweat from his head and arms. "Thank you very much, my friends," he said with his deep, resonant voice and thick Spanish accent. "I'd like to stay and do more for you, but I have to catch a plane to take me back to my family in Chicago." With that simple farewell, he waved to the crowd and disappeared backstage. But it wasn't always like that. Sergio's first entry into the world of physique competition in the U.S. occurred in 1965 at the Mr. Chicago YMCA contest. As he warmed up backstage, the other contestants realized that here was a man to be reckoned with. He was big, weighing around 190, and extremely shapely. His arms were impressive and seemed to grow larger with each curl and press he performed. Unknown to the other contestants, he wasn't avoiding them because of antisocial tendencies. He worked fast and quietly in his corner, avoiding the eyes of his competition because he could not speak a word of English. As his name was called, he mounted the posing platform, a broad smile stretching his face. He jumped left, hopped right, shot his left arm in the air, tensed his right bicep, contracted his pecs, did an about face, and repeated the same gyrations with his back to the audience. He turned, bowed, and left. The crowd buzzed with amazement. What was that? A new dance step? Or maybe the poor fellow has an itch? His posing routine probably took no more than 10 seconds, and he left the stage before the judges could assess his physique. As was to be expected, he failed to place in this local contest, which was won by Steve Kotis, who also beat Sergio for the Mr. Illinois title the same year and went on to capture the most muscular award at the Teenage Mr. America contest. Previous to coming to the U.S., Sergio had been a member of the Cuban weightlifting team. His training in those days was much more strenuous than that of other members of the team. Like other Olympic lifters, the three Olympic lifts plus squats and pulls were practiced 3 days a week in sets of 1 to 5 reps. But because he was also interested in bodybuilding, Sergio would also perform the usual bodybuilding exercises in sets of 15 to 20 reps on his off days. The communists took over the island, and Sergio felt repressed due to the great many restrictions placed upon citizens. When the team made a trip to Jamaica, Sergio saw his opportunity for freedom and sought political asylum at the American embassy because he heard that the U.S. was welcoming refugees from communism. He was transported to Florida, and he worked his way north to Chicago, where he settled in a Spanish-speaking area, which also housed the Division Street YMCA, which contained a well-equipped weight room and had as its instructor future Mr. America Bob Gaida. This was the beginning of a very close and lasting friendship between these two giants of might and muscle. When Gaida got transferred 2 miles away to the Duncan YMCA, it was only natural that Sergio would switch his training to Duncan. It was here that Gaeta transformed a whole YMCA into a weight training club. With his wit and charm, he was able to induce the YMCA officials to enlarge Duncan's weight training facilities to the largest in the world. The bodybuilding area at Duncan measures approximately 50 by 90 feet and is loaded with all manner of equipment. The heavy lifting room is just off the main room and is equipped with numerous Olympic sets, heavy-duty equipment, two platforms, power racks, etc. Surely enough to keep everyone happy. With tons of equipment and publicity, many national lifting and physique champs such as Russ Knipp, Mike Huska, Alan Ball, Phil Grappaldi, Joe Puglio, Larry Scott, Chuck Sipes, John Tristam, and Hank Zarco begin to train at and put on exhibitions at the Duncan YMCA. Everyone benefited from the Gaeta influence. National championships were held in Chicago, and surrounded by all this talent, everyone, including Sergio, trained harder than ever. He was bitten by the bodybuilding bug, and though challenged many times to train with the lifters, he never accepted, but worked twice as hard with his bodybuilding routines, seeming to forget that he was once an Olympic lifter of international caliber. Sergio tells the story about the time during this period when he got a job as a helper, loading and unloading sides of beef on a truck, a job he was well suited for. He arrived at the packaging plant one morning before the sun had risen. Not speaking any English, he was somehow made it known that he was to begin work this day. He helped a truck driver load his truck, and then he went out that day delivering beef and returned quite early in the afternoon. The driver told him that he could leave now, but not understanding English, Sergio thought that they had to come back to the plant for a break, since the sun had not yet set. He no sooner sat down than another driver on the second shift implored him to help load his truck. Not seeing the first driver around, Sergio complied and left with the second driver to complete his rounds. It wasn't until the second week on the job that Sergio was informed that he was only required to work one shift. He was a bit taken by this, since the work was not tiring, and he never made so much money in his life, and he wanted to continue the double shift. But the local union men told him that he would get his boss in trouble if he worked two shifts. So he settled down to work only the early one so that he could get to the gym as early as possible when it was not yet crowded. Although Gaeta and Oliva were the best of friends, training in the same gym at the same time, Oliva could not be induced to follow Bob's example and train according to the now famous peripheral heart action, PHA, or sequence circuit system of training, in which the weight man selects five or six exercises for different muscle groups and proceeds to do a complete circuit, one set of each, before starting on the second set. Oliva preferred training on the conventional pump system and usually included many supersets. Oliva won all the local physique contests after being coached and posing by Gaeta and decided to enter both the junior and senior Mr. America events along with Gaeta. He won the 1966 Junior Mr. America contest along with the Most Muscular award. Gaeta was second in both categories. 1 month later at the Mr. America contest, Gaeta was declared the winner. Sergio received second place, and he took the Most Muscular. It was after the 1966 contest that Sergio decided to intensify his training and go professional. He signed a contract with Weider, and he won the Mr. Olympia title in 1967, 1968, and 1969. And he would probably still be winning if the Austrian Oak Arnold Schwarzenegger hadn't made his appearance. During those years, Sergio married a beautiful Mexican maiden and began raising a family. He had to stop hopping around the world for contests and posing exhibitions and settle down as a good husband and father should. He applied for a job as a Chicago policeman, and he passed the test with flying colors. While waiting to begin training as a police cadet, he secured a job as a physical instructor at the police academy, a job which he enjoyed, but not as much as he would have enjoyed being out in the street with people. He anticipated his appointment eagerly, and then the roof caved in. The federal government declared the police department trust invalid because they discriminated against minority groups. How could this be, he wondered. Here I am, a minority group member who studies hard for tests and I pass with high marks, and the government says I am discriminated against. He was heartbroken, and he considered appealing the ruling, but he was informed the only way he could become a Chicago police officer was to take the next test, and if he was successful, he would again be placed on a waiting list for appointment as a cadet. 3 years of waiting went down the drain, but he was not despondent. Depressed, yes, but despondent, no. He had made contacts in South America and Mexico, and he began starring in Spanish-language films, spending 2 or 3 months on location, and then returning home for a short rest before shooting more film. When the myth enters the gym, everyone knows he's arrived. Leopard pattern shirt,
bright red slacks, highly polished boots, heavy religious jewelry jangling around his neck, thick bracelets encircling his left wrist, heavy rings on four fingers. How can you miss him? He looks like a one-man sideshow. His super size only heightened by his flashy clothes and ornaments. But by chance, if you are engrossed in a set, struggling to force out those last few reps, and you are unaware of his arrival, he makes his presence known by standing over you and throwing forth some words of encouragement. Do it. Push him out. Come on. Try again. One more. Just one more. Don't be at all surprised. He greets everyone in the gym the same way, newcomer or old buddy. Greets them like he has a personal interest in their progress. Hi, Jeff. I hear you do 400 squat last week. It's good. Hey, your arm looked good. Chris, keep it up. You and me, we bench today, okay? And so it goes as he passes through the Duncan YMCA weight room on his way to the locker room. He exchanges a few cordialities, and everyone on this particular day is informed that there are a couple of fellows who drove all the way from Milwaukee to see him train and talk to him. Sergio greets these two strangers with a warm hand clasp and implores that they will wait a few minutes while he changes into a sweatsuit. This is Monday, and on Monday and Thursday, Oliva trains his chest, back, shoulders, and calves. He begins his chest work with bench presses, 135 pounds on the bar, and he goes at the iron like a hungry vulture after meat. He pumps out 50 fast reps, never fully locking out his arms, except on the 25th and the 40th rep. After this first grueling warm-up set, he hops onto the dipping bars, and using body weight only, he pumps out 20 fast dips, going deep and low, but again, not locking out the arms at the completion of each rep. Now he is in his element. It's him against the iron. He performs six more sets of benches, adding weight each set and cutting back on the reps until he's in the area of six reps with 325 pounds, pausing only long enough to do another set of 20 reps and add more weight to this bar. When he reaches his goal for the day, the procedure is reversed. The weight of the bar is decreased and the reps are increased, but on the way down, he does dips with a heavy dumbbell strapped around his waist for sets of 10. The man with the gigantic chest completes 12 sets of bench presses, seven on the way up and five on the way down, and an equal number of sets of dips. He will vary the amount of reps and weight used from workout to workout, but he always does about 12 sets, and he works up to and beyond 300 pounds in fast but strict reps. Next for chest is bent arm laterals. Sergio grabs a pair of moderately heavy dumbbells and lies back on a flat bench, positioning himself so his hips and his legs arch down below the level of the bench with his chest stretched to the utmost. The first set is done for 25 reps with four more sets of 15 reps to follow with heavier dumbbells. Each rep is performed with a wide fling of the arms so that the pecs are stretched maximally. At the completion of each rep, the bells are touched over the chest so that the inner pecs receive full stimulation. By this time, his chest looks positively immense. It is the biggest, broadest, and thickest chest in the universe, and it's getting bigger with each set. The seams of his sweatshirt are ready to burst, but by some miracle, they're still holding. Between sets of flies, the myth performs sets of 15 reps of wide grip chins behind the neck, using body weight only and never completely stretching out his arms at the bottom of each chin. After completing his chest work, the big Cuban unscrews the top of a thermos jug and he sips a mixture of half and half and Blair's protein. The two Milwaukee visitors note that the object of their admiration is taking a short break, and they decided to use the opportunity to ask him a question. Do you always drink that? Asked the taller of the two. No, replies Sergio, only when I want to gain weight. I try to weigh 240 this year for contests. He uses Blair's protein and cream mixture. The visitor decides to try one more question. Do you like the Nautilus machines? We no got any here in the gym, replies Sergio, but on Sunday mornings I go to Chicago Health Club and I use their machines. Flexing his big tricep, he continues. The arm machine real good. I get great burn when I use it. I work for Arthur Jones in Florida, and I use the Nautilus machines every day. His best and most honest man for weightlifting in country. With this statement, Sergio begins loading plates on one end of the bar, which has a hinge attached to the floor on the other end. Bending over from the waist, he takes a wide grip on the crossbar, and he slowly pulls the bar to his chest, lowering the bar moderately slowly and spreading his wing-like lats with each rep. The procedure is completed 15 reps for a warm-up. He then goes to the lat machine, kneels down on the floor, sets a selector pin with a wide grip, pulls the bar down behind his neck for 15 reps. He adds weight to the pivot bar for another set of reps and immediately goes to the lat pulldowns for another set of pulldowns. After his initial warm-up sets are completed,
He proceeds to do 5 sets of 10 to 15 reps in each of these 2 exercises. He is beginning to look unreal. Veins and capillaries radiate out the top of his chest and into his neck, where their appearance is almost too much to believe. He looks bigger than the proverbial house. Next, he goes to a decline bench and sets a 100-pound dumbbell on the floor at the head end. Lying back on the bench, he grabs the inside underside of the plates and performs 15 reps of pullovers with his elbows slightly unlocked. 4 more sets of 15 reps are performed. After each set of pullovers, he does a set of V-bar pull-ups, arching well back and pulling his chest up to the bar and stretching way down at the end of each rep. Sergio finishes his lat work by doing pulls to the chest on a lat machine, 5 sets of 10 reps. He inserts 2 handles in the lat machine cable, places 1 hand in each, kneels on the floor, and proceeds to pull the handles from the overhead position straight down to his chest, spreading the broad lats with each of the 5 sets of 10 reps he performs. By now, he looks like the biggest thing on this or any other planet. Through his damp training shirt, the muscles of his back are straining to break out and seek the freedom of a more civilized life. Having done justice to his upper back, Sergio breaks for another drag at the thermos and the life-sustaining protein. He sees one of the visitors hurriedly scratching notes on a pad of paper. "Hey, you write down everything you see, yes?" he asks jovially and continues. "Next time you come here, you maybe see my brother Diego. I look like a little kid next to him. He is my big brother. Steel back in Cuba with my 15 brother and sister. His biggest, strongest man on the whole island, and someday he come to the U.S. Now, with just shoulder work to do, he starts moving into the home stretch of today's workout. The 3-time Mr. Olympia places a pair of squat stands on either side of a flat exercise bench and flips a 135-pound Olympic bar on them. Sitting down in front of the bar and using a grip slightly wider than shoulder width, he hoists the bar off the rack and pumps out 15 fast presses behind the neck, never quite extending his arms all the way or locking out the elbows. He adds 10 pounds to the bar and does 10 reps. The Cuban adds an additional 5 or 10 pounds of each over the next 8 sets, keeping the rep between 5 and 10, performing a total of 10 sets of presses behind the neck. He supersets the first 5 sets with alternate forward raise with 20-pound dumbbells, 20 reps each set, and supersets the last 5 sets of press behind the neck with lateral raise with 25-pound dumbbells, also doing 20 reps per set. In each of these 2 dumbbell exercises, the arms are raised only until they are parallel with the floor. 10 sets of 20 reps of seated calf raise is done on a modified leg press machine, supersetted with 1 leg calf raise while standing on a high block, ends his first workout of the week, and sweat-soaked, weary man bids a cheery adios to all and heads for a hot shower and then home for supper with his wife and children. Tuesdays and Fridays workouts are not as long as the previous day's sessions. Legs, calves, and abdominals are on the schedule, and as Sergio enters the gym, there is talk that he will be leaving for Japan shortly to put on a posing exhibition. He dismisses the rumor mongers by telling him that he has no time for idle chatter tonight, as he must train fast so that he'll be on time for a dinner engagement he has later. After changing into a bright red sweatsuit with arms cut out to release his mighty appendages, the myth begins his legwork by doing 3 fast sets of 20 reps of leg extensions as a warm-up. Squats will consume the major part of today's activity, and as Sergio goes about the task of setting the racks at the proper height, you can see that he is psyching himself up for another bone-breaking, teeth-straining session. With 135 pounds on the bar, the big man clasps the bar with his hands wide apart, steps forward, tucks his head under the bar, and lets it come to rest on his big trapezius. He straightens up, takes 2 steps backward, plants his feet flat on the wooden gym floor, and proceeds to pump out 50 fast reps. With his chest heaving like wheat in a shifting breeze, the big man replaces the bar on the racks and immediately walks to the leg curl machine. He sets the weight at the appropriate poundage and does 20 leg curls, stretching his legs as far as possible with each rep. A few deep breaths and his breathing has returned to normal. 25-pound plates are lifted onto the squat bar and the Cuban does 25 reps. With breathing only slightly accelerated, he returns to the bar to the racks and he does another set of leg curls, this time using only 15 reps with additional weight. Back to the squat racks where the 25s are removed and the bar is replaced by 45s. 15 reps pumped out in nonstop fashion, and then over to the leg curls for another set of 10 reps. And so it goes through another 7 more sets of squats, increasing the poundage with each set until 405 pounds are on the bar
and 10 back-breaking, man-killing reps are performed. Between each set of 10 squats are performed 10 sets of leg curls with increasing poundage. By the time those 20 sets are completed, we see vascularity and muscles in the legs we never knew existed. Out comes the all-too-familiar jug of protein and cream mixture. Off comes the cap. He tilts his head back, and an 8-ounce swig slides down his throat. Wiping his mouth with the towel, the cap is replaced. He saunters to the drinking fountain, rinses his mouth out, splashes some cool water on his face, dries the excess, and sits himself down under the leg press machine, which conveniently happens to be loaded to 300 pounds. 15 reps are pushed out effortlessly, and he rises, sets himself under the calf machine, points his toes slightly outward, and does 20 heel raises, keeping the knees perfectly straight and stretching the heels within inches of the floor with each downward thrust. Alternating between the leg press machine and calf, he does a total of 5 sets of each, adding weight for each set, working to 500 pounds for 10 reps on the leg press machine and 315 pounds for 20 reps on the calf work. As he walks through the drinking fountain, the gym is quiet. All work has ceased. Barbells remain motionless in moist hands. Dumbbells have stopped their ascent. Pulleys remain inoperative. All eyes are fixed on the 230-pound giant, his gargantuan thighs pressing against the velour of his red sweatsuit, each pair of eyes envying the giant who walks among them. "What a man," someone whispers, and the silence is broken as all go back to their previous activities. Sergio sits down on the leg extension machine, forces out 15 reps, and then goes to the seated calf raise machine, the same one used yesterday, and he does 20 calf raises. Weight is added to the leg extension machine, and he does 10 more reps, and the calf machine, where he repeats for another 20 reps. The procedure continues until a total of 5 sets of each exercise is completed, 1 set of 15 and 4 sets of 10 for the leg extension, and a straight 20 reps for the seated calf raises. Ah, he can almost taste that dinner as he prepares to complete the day's training session. He takes a long, cool drink of water and then begins his abdominal training. Blessed by nature with extremely small hips and a waist which has no more fat on it than the amount of fat on the back of the average man's hand, Sergio still does sufficient waist work to keep his abdominals looking sharp, though not extremely well-defined. His waist training usually consists of 2 exercises, sit-ups and leg raises done on an abdominal board. Setting the board at the desired height and holding his hands clasped behind his head, the big man with the tiny waist does 30 crunchy-type sit-ups. That is, sit-ups in which he comes all the way up until his elbows touch his knees, but on the downstroke, he stops before his upper back touches the board. This is the way most of the champs are doing their sit-ups these days, and Sergio's no exception. Immediately after doing the sit-ups, he turns around on the abdominal board so that his head is at the top end, clasps the top of the board with his hands, and proceeds to do 30 leg raises with slightly bent knee position. The sit-ups and leg raises are repeated for from 3 to 5 sets, depending upon the available time, and the height of the board is adjusted according to his desires at that particular time. Sometimes the board is kept low, and other times it's raised high. The choice is usually made on the spur of the moment. Today, the board was kept at the low angle. After the last rep, he rolled off the board, picked up his thermos bottle and towel, waves goodbye to all, and muttering something under his breath about being late for an appointment, makes a beeline for the shower room. Arm training for Sergio is like arm training for most of us. It is a labor of love, and though he has achieved that distinction of building arms that measure 20-plus inches, he still works them as hard, if not harder, than he ever has. As he entered the gym Wednesday, wearing a pair of blue shorts and a white sweatshirt with the arms cut out, the first thing you notice is those ham-like arms. They are unbelievable. Big, thick, shapely, and unbeatable combination. As your eyes roll down his arms, you note the forearms. No one has ever asked you about their measurement, but you must guess they'd stretch the tape between 16 and 17 inches. And then you note the hands and fingers. They are even more unbelievable than his arms and forearms. He extends his hand in friendship with a smiling, "How are you? I see you know for a long time." You nod and say something incomprehensible and look at that right hand extended for you to shake. You try to grab his hand and show that the feeling of friendship is mutual, but your hand gets lost in his. He gives a couple of firm shakes and releases it. It feels like you've been momentarily held captive by a giant, loving black bear. Hands you have never seen, such hands. They look like 16-ounce boxing gloves with fingers. And fingers, just try to imagine what a 16-ounce boxing glove with hot dogs attached as fingers would look like, and then you get some idea of what the Oliva hands look like.
You must see them to believe them. So as not to be repetitious, it might be well to point out here that Sergio does all of his tricep work in a non-lockout fashion. That is, he stops each tricep exercise before he has completed the movement, thereby keeping tension on the triceps at all times and not letting them relax. Tricep work begins with pulley tricep curls. Kneeling in front of a pulley arrangement, which resembles a lat pulldown, 45-degree handle held in the center, the big man begins an hour and 15 minutes of concentrated arm work. Arms held tight at the sides, he extends them until they reach the three-quarter position. No pause, and he bends the arms and straightens them out again and again and again and again, 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 until he has completed between 25 and 30 reps for his first warm-up set. A couple deep breaths are taken, weight is added to the machine, and 15 reps are done. A few more long, deep breaths, more plates added, and another 10 reps. Weight is added for each of the next three sets of 10. The day's work has just begun, and already his arms look pumped to the maximum. Without hesitation, he goes into French curls, using 135 pounds for 10 reps. Then pounds are added to the bar, and four more super strict, searing sets of French curls are performed with less than a minute between sets. Next comes the Oliva Favorites, a series of four different tricep exercises, each done for five sets for 10 to 15 reps apiece. One arm at a time, all done without a pause between arms until all 20 sets of each arm are completed. With his back to a wall pulley, the giant grasps the bottom handle with his right hand. He stands upright, braces that ham-like right hand against the side of his head, and proceeds to perform one-arm tricep curls for 15 reps. After the last rep, he immediately switches the handle to his left hand and performs 15 reps with that side. With no pause or break in the rhythm, he keeps alternating arms until he has completed five sets of 10 to 15 reps with each arm. From this starting position, the right forearm, he grasps one of the top handles with his right hand and stretches it out to the right side so that he appears to be crucified. From this starting position, the right upper arm is kept parallel to the ground and the forearm is bent so that the hand comes in back of the neck, a sort of one-arm tricep curl out to the side rather than an overhead, and then straightened to the crucifix position again. This is repeated for 10 to 15 reps, and then the handle is switched to the left hand for the like number of reps. Back and forth the handle goes until you can almost see smoke rising from its smooth silver surface. Back and forth until five sets of 10 to 15 reps are performed with each arm. And what an arm! Consider yourself among the fortunate few if you've ever had the opportunity to see that arm in action. A sight you won't forget. Facing the wall pulley and bending from the waist with his left hand on the left leg for support, Sergio grabs the bottom handle with his right hand. Pressing the right arm against his side, he extends the arm to the rear in a false jerky-type fashion, bends the arm and repeats for 10 to 15 reps, switches the handle to the left hand, and keeps going without a break until five more sets have been completed. Approaching his last tricep exercise, you can see that the big man is undecided. He usually does either one of two exercises, and he's not quite sure which one to do today. Aha! He's made his decision, and he goes for the job at hand. Facing the pulley machine, he moves in close, grasps the top handle in his right hand, keeping the right arm pressed against his side, he extends the handle towards the floor, bends the arms, and straightens the arm, bending and straightening until 10 to 15 reps have been pumped out. The same is repeated with the left arm, and the routine is kept up for a total of five sets of 10 to 15 reps. This completes Sergio's tricep work, though he may occasionally do some dips between sets of tricep exercises. Sergio has his tricep down to an exact science. He knows exactly what exercises, how many sets, how much weight to use, the reps, and how often to train to elicit the best results for his body type. A few flexes of those mighty triceps as the myth swallows some cool water at the fountain, and he's ready to begin his bicep work. First, 15 barbell curls with an Olympic bar, 25 reps for a warm-up with 105 pounds, 135 pounds next for 15 reps. Four more sets to failure. Each set means an increase in weight, but the reps are maintained between 10 and 15. Next for biceps is spider bench curls. The spider bench can best be described as an inclined preacher bench, a bench that allows you to lie down and do curls over the top of a preacher bench. The big Cuban drapes his gargantuan arms over the top of the bench, their size being accentuated due to the pressure exerted against the bench. He reaches forward, grasps an easy curl bar at the grips, and begins curling, pulling all the way up to his chin and lowering it down until his arms are extended to their utmost at the bottom of each rep. He completes 10 reps, places the bar on the floor, rises, stretches for a few seconds, reassumes his position on the bench, and repeats for a total of 10 sets of 10 reps. Last exercise, and those arms look like something out of an H.G. Wells novel. Unreal. Over to the curling machine moves the giant. Loading the machine to 200 pounds, he snaps the cable in place, wipes his forehead with the towel, seats himself, braces his arms, grasps the handle, and begins curling up, down, goes to 200 pounds as the cable slides over the wheel, up, down, until 10 reps have been done. A few stretches, a deep breath or two, more weight added, and the monotonous routine continues until 10 sets of 10 reps have been performed. This is Wednesday, and with the last set of curls on the curling machine completed, Oliva has finished his workout for the day. Had this been a Saturday, the Cuban bombshell would not be leaving the gym as soon as on Saturday he does a little more work for the rest of his body. Chest, back, shoulders, thighs, calves, and abdominals all receive their share of additional exercises on Saturday so as to ensure that each part is worked 3 times per week. The extra work on Saturday is nowhere near as strenuous or severe as the Monday, Thursday, Tuesday, Friday workouts. There is usually no set plan or sets or reps with this extra work. The myth works according to the dictates at the time. All right, that is an article written by Norman Zell in the December 1975 issue of Iron Man magazine, the original Iron Man magazine that was owned by Perry and Mabel Rader. All right, that is it for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Pat Comer for sending me that article. I hope you guys enjoyed it. We will see you next week for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Take care.